It's been quite a momentous week. Many terrible things have happened in the news. Boston, Texas, many lives lost, much pain and suffering. And perhaps during this week, as we've seen these things happen, we've taken stock for a moment and thought about the important things in our life. Now, I won't ask you to do it. Don't take out a piece of paper unless you're keeping notes. But consider, what are perhaps the five things that you would consider the most important in your life? Five things, shall we say. Maybe the first thing that came to your mind just then was God as your number one most important thing. I would think in this room that that would be reasonable, that we would think of God as most important. And then perhaps some of us thought spouse, my wife, my husband, my children, my family, my friends. Were those some of the thoughts that came into your mind? Were those some of the words that immediately popped in as you thought of those five things, those five important things? We consider this list, we realize that most of these things that are very important to us are living beings. God is a living being, and we have a relationship with him. And these people, the spouse, the family, the friends, they're living beings, and we have relationships with them, and they're very important to us. And well, maybe if we don't have a spouse and children, maybe, you know, number four on the list might be our career. And let's face it, if we're, you know, in our 20s and single on our own, maybe number five is the TV set or the car. You know, those are pretty nice things to have, aren't they? That's okay. But basically, the things that we would list as most important are the things in our personal life, the relationships. And the reason we don't consider the things first, the TV, the car, the house, well, it's because we have a relationship with God, because we have relationships with people. We say we love them. We love God, and they love us. We love our families. They love us in return. Now, love is a very interesting word. The English word, love, has many facets, many translations. Let's think about that for a moment. I mean, you could say you love your wife. You can say you love your country. You could say you love your easy chair or your car. But do you mean the same thing? Do you love your wife the same way you love your easy chair? I really hope not. Because she knows. She knows. It has a different meaning each time it's used, doesn't it? It means something different. It's a very ambiguous word in some ways. It's not easy to nail it down exactly what it means. It has to be within the context of some communication before it actually means what it means. You have to know what we're talking about. What is the subject? So it has a different meaning each time it's used. You know, if you compare your love for your children to the love for your car, it has two different meanings. And if you discuss all these other things, then it has all those other meanings. It just has so many. Philosophers have written books about love, waxing eloquently about love, what it is, what it isn't, what it might be, what it could be. Poets have written wonderful, flowery words about love in all its various forms, pining away for lost love. If you like music, I'm sure most of us do in some form or another, you know, country music, rock music, rap music, all these different musics, all of them at some point come up with love as a very important subject. It's really on our minds. It's very important. Some say love is divine. Some say love is noble. Some say love is non-existent. Some say love is enslavement, that it blocks you from being happy. Yeah, and there's some psychologists that go down that route. They say that love is enslavement and you can't be happy. Love is just a myth. Now, interestingly, if you look up the word love in the English dictionary, it has a fairly simple definition. It really does. It says, love is to have a strong attraction or affection for someone. It means to have a strong liking or interest in a thing. Or it means a strong, usually passionate affection for someone of the opposite sex. Fairly simple, isn't it? Fairly straightforward. Seems to make a lot of sense. You know, we say we love something, then we're saying we have a strong liking or affection for this person or this thing. you know, I'm really attracted to you. I really like you. We use the word love. And that's usually what we mean when we say or use the word love. You know, some say that love is the answer to all the world's evils. You know, even here in this room, we talk love all the time. In sermons right now, we talk about it all the time, don't we? It comes up constantly. Why is that? Well, read the Bible. Love is throughout the Old and New Testament. It's a very common word in there. I haven't counted all the number of times, but I don't think it's important. It's just in there a lot. And it means different things. And understanding those meanings can completely change the meaning of a verse or what you're reading in there. You know, the Bible tells us to love God, doesn't it? It tells us to love our neighbors. It tells us to love our enemies. What? That's crazy. You know, others say you can't do any of those things unless you love yourself first. So what's it all mean? Love, what's it all mean? What does it all mean? 1 John. Let's turn to 1 John to start off here. 1 John chapter 4. If you go through 1 John, you'll find love mentioned a lot. It is in there. 1 John chapter 4. He uses this word a ton of times. What's he talking about? Where is he? There he is. Got him. 1 John 4, verse 7. You know, people will say, John is so mushy. What in the world does he mean? Was he a Protestant? Because all he talked about is love. Love, 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 love. So what does it mean? Verse 7 again. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. Now, if we apply the English definition of love, remember what that was? Strong affection for. Let's read it again, and we'll put that in there in the place of the word love. Beloved, let us have strong affection to one another, for strong affection is of God, and everyone who has strong affection is born of God and knows God. Now, is that what he's saying? Is he saying that if we have strong affection, that we're of God and born of God? It's okay, you can nod or shake your head no. Go ahead. No, he's not, is he? I think we all realize that. It's obvious. That's not what he's saying. But seriously, if we apply the English definition of the word love, that's exactly what he's saying. Now, verse 9 is very important in this passage because it begins to hint, it begins to look behind what we're really talking about. Verse 9 says, "In this was manifested the love of God towards us, because God sent his only begotten Son into the world that we might live through him." Why am I up here today? Well, I'm here because I want to inspire you to listen to an 8-sermon series done by Gary Petty about love, about what it means and what it is. Some of you maybe already have recognized some of his words and what I've said. I see Mr. Meininger smiling. So, you know, I was so amazed by the very first sermon that I had to go, we need to hear this. All of us here need to hear this. And so I wanted to bring that to you today and tell you it's some of the most important information we could ever learn. What it is, what it means. It defines the nature of God, and we need to understand it so we can become it. Verse 9, again, "In this the love of God was manifest towards us, that God has sent his only begotten Son into this world that we might live through him, and this is love." What he's saying here is you need to understand this. You need to understand that love is always expressed through action. Not always emotion. Always expressed through action. And this is love. Not that we loved God, but he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, so also should we ought to love one another. So what does John mean? What does John mean? If we go to the first century Greek, they had many words that were translated love in the English Bible. Okay, we've heard this before. Yeah, Steve, we know that. There's all those different words. It's very interesting. What are you talking about? Well, we need to realize that this is the core of all of our, of a lot of the problems that we have. Do you have a broken relationship with anybody? Are you having problems with brethren in the church? Do brethren in the church have problems with each other? Anybody remember a couple of years ago the challenges that we had, that we faced as a body, and that tore us apart? If this principle had been applied, it wouldn't have happened. We need to understand this. We need to carry this with us. We have a core problem when relationship is broken that we don't go here. We might think it's some other thing. Oh, they did this or they did that. But this is really what it's all about. Maintaining a relationship, understanding what real love is, that it's expressed in actions. The Greeks, again, had many different words that could be translated love. Now, this one's not in the Bible, and I don't even know what it is. But it's a specific word that directly means, it talks about family love. It's not a word that you would use with your best friend. It's not even a word that you would use with your teacher who you really like. It's a word you would use with your spouse, your children, your father, your mother, your aunt, your uncle. Blood relationship love is what it effectively means. It's saying, I love you as a family. I love you because you're my family. That's one of the words in Greek. We might be more familiar with the next word, eros. It's also not in the Bible, but it refers to a love between a man and a woman. It can be romantic, passionate, yes, even in a broad sense, sexual. It's a specific relationship between a man and a woman. That is what that word means. And the one we're very familiar with, the one we've heard the most about, perhaps, is phileo, or philia. Philadelphia, brotherly love. It's what it's all about. It's found a lot in the New Testament. It is all over the place. Now, phileo can be defined as love towards someone you have an interest in. Love that you have towards someone that you have an interest in, a common interest. I care for you, so I'm willing to act in this particular unselfish way. I like you, so I have filio for you. And I'll be nice to you and, you know, share with you and be kind to you because I like you. It could be described as the love between friends, best of friends. Okay? It could even describe the love between a husband and a wife, believe it or not. I love you, and so I'll make you dinner. You know, I'll wash your clothes. I'll go out and work hard all day to help pay the bills. That's filio. And that's perfectly fine. It's a beautiful thing. It's wonderful to care for people. It's absolutely required and important that we love, that we have this philia love for each other. It's perfectly fine. It's wonderful. You know, a husband and wife could also have that family love that I talked about a few minutes ago for each other. They could have eros. I sure hope they do. You know, if they're a husband and wife. They could have, again, philia towards each other. They all mean something different. They're very specific in their areas, but they mean different things. And they express feelings and action. I feel and I act in this particular way. You know, filio is not only an emotion, it is expressed in actions. But it tends to be very exclusive. We have probably all experienced filio, in a national sense. Ever been at a baseball game? Got up, you know, sang the national anthem? In that moment, just then, didn't you feel connected to everybody in the building? 10, 20, 30,000 people all singing the same song together. It's a wonderful feeling, isn't it? You know, if some bad guys dropped in and started doing terrible things, you'd probably defend the guy standing next to you and you don't even know his name. Just because of this feeling, this strong feeling. You know, men in combat will feel intense brotherly love, filio, for each other. They're in a foxhole together. Hand grenade rolls in. Guy throws himself on it, dies to save his friend next to him. And that's filial. That's this feeling of patriotism, this feeling of, I will do this because you mean something to me, because you give me something, you provide something to me. And it is self-sacrificing. Okay, here's a thought. Same soldier gets captured by the enemy. Same soldier who would have saved his friend by throwing himself on their hand grenade. Being marched off by the enemy, hand grenade comes rolling in, throws himself on top of it to save his enemies. Ever hear of that happening? Philia doesn't go that far. It doesn't cross that line. See, he doesn't have anything in common with his enemies. He doesn't want to protect them. Why should I give my life for them? You know, they're taking things from me and my country and my people. I don't feel brotherly love for this person. Why should I save them? Now, you know, again, filio is self-sacrificing, but just for those you're bound to, those you have common interests with. The concept, then, that we're talking about, this other word, this fourth word, if you will, is agape. And that's the word that John uses in 1 John. Agape, we've all heard it before, most of us. Agape, it's an interesting word. Interestingly enough, in the first century Greek, agape is a very ambiguous word. It's not really well defined. It's got a lot of meanings, but it's kind of hard to nail down exactly what it is. You know, they use it in philosophy a lot. It's this really big thing. It's very common in the New Testament, though, as well. And why? Well, the New Testament writers took this word, this really big word, and it was just love. They took this really big word and said, let's use this to explain the ultimate form of love. You know, God is not only love of family. God is not eros, and God is not filial. God is bigger than all that. Huge. All those other things, nothing compared to this thing that God is. Huge. That's what 1 John uses, and that is what God is. God is agape, and you must have the verb form, agapeo, towards each other. If we are going to understand God and His love for us, and then we need to understand God, I mean, we need to understand that so we can have it for each other because we're required to. Agape isn't just a description of God, it's what we are to become. It's what we are to become as children of God. We can have filio and not be children of God. People can have enormous amounts of filio love. They can be very giving, very kind, do tremendous acts of service, give their very lives, still not have agape. That's a tough idea, isn't it? It's really hard to understand, and how can it be? We have to understand, we need to come to an in-depth understanding of the definition of agape. If you go to a Greek dictionary, you're not going to find it. Mr. Petty in his first sermon mentions that he did go to a Greek dictionary and he had 50 pages of Greek words after it. He doesn't read Greek. So 50 pages of Greek words, you know, blah, 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 all about agape. And the English translation said, go to the New Testament and figure it out there. In effect, is what it said. One statement. We can't really describe it. Go to the New Testament and figure it out for yourself. Whoa. The ancient Greeks didn't have it. You have to understand what the Bible is teaching to understand what this word means. It's become a uniquely Christian word. It was taken from the ancient Greeks because they didn't even know what it was. In effect, the Bible took, the writers of the Bible, God inspiring them, said, take this word, put it in there, And I'll tell you what it is. It's me, and I'm going to explain it to you in there. Figure it out. So what is it? What is it that God is that you and I are supposed to become? Now, we know that love involves emotions. Agape transcends emotions. Here's the challenge. When all actions towards other people are based on our emotions, then we tend to only associate with, listen to, and treat well people who think like we do. When we understand agape, we will understand that it is always described, it is always realized in actions. We have to understand that it is a process of mind, and yes, emotions can be involved. There's nothing wrong with that. But it is primarily a process of mind, a choice, a decision. We must choose our actions towards others, and at the same time, we might have exactly the opposite feelings towards them. Huh? How do I do that? Let's put agape into a greater context. Turn to Matthew 5. Let's go to Matthew 5. And to grasp this larger concept a little bit, it's Jesus Christ in the Sermon on the Mount. He's talking to everybody. And Matthew 5, verse 38. Let's just read it to start with. Matthew 5, 38. You have heard it that it has been said, an eye for an eye, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. Now, many have interpreted this law from the Old Testament, which is he's quoting here. They've interpreted it to read that the Old Testament advocates revenge. Revenge. Eye for an eye. Poke out his eye, you lose your eye. Break his arm, you break your arm. You know, that sort of thing. That's what people think the Bible is teaching, what the Old Testament taught. And that's not what the Old Testament was teaching. What it was saying was let the punishment fit the crime. That's all. Just let the punishment fit the crime. You know, you've heard about thieves in other parts of the world. They get captured and they cut their hands off. And they do it because they say the Bible teaches that. The Bible doesn't teach that. The Quran teaches that. So you have a lot of crippled people walking around who can't work for themselves and basically have to resort to a life of being a thief, which is what they already were. How were they helped? The punishment doesn't fit the crime. They're crippled. They can't work. Jesus Christ is here telling us to let the punishment fit the crime. That principle still stands and was founded by God. But he takes it another step. But I tell you, not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him also have your cloak. If someone compels you to go with them a mile, go too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. You've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. By the way, love your neighbor is in the Bible. We all know that. We've determined that. Hate your enemy is not. It was a common saying of the time, and he was mentioning this common saying to them to show the contrast to what he was going to say next. I say to you, love your enemies. Let's think about this for a minute. Love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hurt you. Pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. And why? That you may be the sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes the sun rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. Verse 46 is pretty key, pretty important. Let's try to understand this. If you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? Now, in that time frame, the tax collectors were kind of considered traitors. They were Jews that went to work for the Romans to collect taxes from their friends and their families and their brothers and give it to the bad guys. They were traitors. Don't the traitors do the same thing? One of the proofs of discipleship is that we love one another. Others are to see our love as proof that we are children of God. But if all we do is love one another, how are we different from the local mosque? How are we different from insert alternate religion here? Mormons, nice people. They love one another. How about the Buddhists? Well, they sacrifice for one another. Hindu, they give to one another. They all spend time with each other in each other's homes. Okay, what's going on here? It's getting a little scary. Okay, I'm going to take you a little further down the rabbit hole. Back in the end of World War II, as Germany was beginning to fall to the Allied powers, the Russians were rolling into Berlin. Adolf Hitler gathered up all the young boys and gave them some minimal training with this horrible high-explosive weapon. Now, they weren't suicide bombers, not directly. They would run through the rubble, calling to one another, laughing and, you know, making a game of this thing and fire this weapon at tanks. It was called a Panzer killer. Panzer is German for tank, basically. Big, you know, scary machine thingy. And they would fire them at the tanks and they, boom, blow them up and kill all these soldiers. All these Russian soldiers were dying, thousands of them. And these kids were having a gas. They were having a great time, running and laughing, and the Russian soldiers could hear them laughing and giggling in the rubble as they popped up and killed them. After the war, the Russian commanders were interviewed, and they told how it broke their hearts to have to machine gun these children. It was the only way they could survive. There's a newsreel that shows Adolf Hitler walking among these children, smiling at them, touching their faces as they saluted him and as they smiled at him. And you could see the look of adoration in their eyes. And the look of adoration shone from his face to these little boys that he was sending off. They just wanted to hug each other. There was all this affection. It was wonderful. It was joyous between this evil man and these little innocent boys. Now, if all love is affection, remember the definition? What was it? Affection. Strong affection. If that's all it is, Adolf Hitler was a wonderful man. He was a very loving man because at that moment he felt supreme phileo for those boys and they for him. Is that enough? No. Jesus says, if that's all it is, why are we any different from Adolf Hitler? If you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Don't even the traitors, the Jews, who work for the Romans, don't they do that? Verse 48 defines our destination, where we're headed, where we want to be. Verse 48. Have I lost myself here? Therefore you shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Our Father in heaven is agape. Jesus is saying here, you must become agape. How do we do this? How do we do this? Let's turn to Romans 5. This passage here in Romans 5 connects to 1 John. Romans 5 it really helps to define our starting point as we begin to try to understand this concept of agape that we must become and that God is. Romans 5. What we need to do is take this enormous concept of agape and break it down into smaller things that we can understand. Actions. We need to get down into absolute actions. so that we can be this enormous concept, so that we can move towards the actions that will become agape in our lives. And these actions would take eight sermons, apparently take eight sermons to get through. And they're out there. But let's continue for a little more as I try to inspire you to listen to those eight sermons. Romans 5, verse 8. But God commended his love towards us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. This is the central core that we need to understand. This is it. If there's a conflict between a husband and wife, this is it. This is the central thing they need to get back to. This is where you start to solve that problem. If there's a conflict between you and another brethren in the church, this is where you go to understand what you need to do. There's probably going to be more conflict within our group. Sad to say it, there probably will be. Within the body of Christ at large, sure. Certainly within the world, but within this body where we need to love one another, this is where we need to go when those problems come up. Each and every one of us needs to make this our personal responsibility to understand and put into action. It's not what we think it is. It isn't the problem. It isn't the thing they did. This is the problem. This is the thing we need to understand and put into action. This is where the understanding of agape starts. Right here. Romans 5, verse 8. But God commended his love towards us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God showed his love for me while I was still despicable. Yeah. While I was unlovable, he sacrificed his son for me and for you and for everyone. If we're going to understand agape, we need to start with the action performed by God. Certainly not the emotion that he must have felt, but the action. While we were disgusting, Christ died for you and for me. Wow. And that's how God tells us and expresses what agape is. I hope this blows your mind just a little bit, because it certainly exploded in my head when we've heard this all before, haven't we? This is nothing new. Have I surprised you with anything? No. But we need to think about these things and focus in on them and understand them. Really get at the core of what is going on and put it into action. So how do I express this concept of agape to others? By understanding the broad principle that's stated right there. As we come to our conclusion here, with what we've read so far in 1 John and in Matthew and Romans 5:8, we can now begin to break down this broad principle into some smaller action points. We can begin to build a definition of agape that we can understand. We will still find agape to be a very large principle, a very large concept, a very big thing that is completely out of our reach without God's Spirit and God living in us. Let's understand that agape, as we've already stated, involves a way of thinking and includes motives. God did not sacrifice his son because we and he had the same interests, right? We weren't on the same page. We weren't on the same team. We were enemies. Love in the English language means you have the same interests. We had no interests in common with God when he sacrificed his son for us. Secondly, agape involves self-sacrifice. And here's the hard part. Here's the big thing. Here's the heavy. Agape is not contingent on how the other person treats you, or Jesus would have never allowed himself to be sacrificed. Agape is not contingent on how the other person treats you. Agape is unselfish, outgoing concern for everyone. That's what God had and is. Outgoing, unselfish concern for everyone, even if you don't have the same interests and even if the other person in your eyes is unlovable. When someone's unlovable, do you have good feelings for them? Not me. I just want to get away from them. I don't want to have anything to do with them. But agape is the opposite. It's doing what's in the best interest of others, even when they're unlovable. It's hard. I'm not kidding you. It's difficult. It's impossible. But with God, all things are possible. We have to look out for the best interest of someone who is, in our eyes, despicable. And that's what God did for us, you and me. What was in our best interest? What did we deserve? What does he want to give us? It always comes down to the action. We state it again, agape is always expressed in action. God expressed his agape in sacrificing his son while we were still sinners. And yes, it's an enormous concept. And that's what makes that sermon series so vitally important for all of us. So let's act and reach out. Take a hold of this information and begin to understand what we must become.